Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Stephen Cole and Jason Graw. We also review A Raisin in the Sun, Guys and Dolls at Carnegie Hall, and Transport Group's I Remember Mama. This plus much more, so please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 6, 2014. My name is James Marino and the broadcast this morning is Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So you're traveling all over the U.S. and it is opening week in Major League Baseball. Are those things related?
Not at all. I didn't see a single game, but I sure saw some good theater.
Excellent. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at Final Spot Photo, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Morning. And you are getting over this little cold that I am as well?
Yeah, not so little.
Yeah, I was down for the count much of this week. I, in fact, had to cancel on If Then because I couldn't see it. We will talk about If Then probably next week because we have so much to talk about this week. So let's jump right in. With us this morning, joining us directly from the York Theater and in rehearsal is Jason Graw and Stephen Cole, where they are putting together Inventing Mary Martin. So, guys, thanks so much for joining us on a Sunday morning and during rehearsal.
Yes, we're thrilled, of course, to do it.
I'm so excited to get out of rehearsal to get to do this.
Yes.
Sorry.
Wait, who's your stage manager?
Bernita, she's the best.
Yes, Bernita Robinson. She's sitting there waiting for us.
Yes, she is.
She's looking at the watch.
Yes.
All right, so tell us, what's happening with Inventing Mary Martin?
Well, we are just finishing up week two of rehearsals, and heading towards the home stretch with tech, and it's going very, very well, isn't it, Jason?
Yes, Stephen.
Yes.
I think it is. We're having a ball. We're having such a ball doing this.
I mean, the material is so great. I mean, forget that I wrote it and directed it and conceived it. We're talking about the songs of a lifetime here. Forget me. Talk about Jason. I mean, we've got songs from South Pacific and The Sound of Music, and we've got My Heart Belongs to Daddy. It's almost like it's amazing.
You know, of course, we're all familiar with Peter Pan and Sound of Music and South Pacific and I Do and One Touch of Venus, which is a spectacular score. So I came into the show knowing those songs and being familiar with those shows. But the stuff that's really been fun and eye-opening and ear-opening are the songs that she originated in Hollywood and sang out there that I had no idea what those songs were. And there are some gems, really amazing.
Yeah, what most people don't know is that she was at Paramount for 4 years and made 10 movies with stars like Bing Crosby and Dick Powell. And there were great songwriters going on there. Yeah. And then even the shows, she had two shows close out of town, which is amazing, early in her career. And those songs are great. We're talking about Vernon Duke and Howard Beetz. And so we're really touching on some obscurities as well as the big numbers.
Yeah, I can't believe...
Peter, you were going to ask a question. What was it?
Jason, is this your first time playing Mary Martin?
while sober, yes.
Does it count?
No one plays Mary Martin except me.
This might be a good time to mention the other cast members.
Oh yeah, Emily Skinner. Yeah, there are other people.
Oh my God,
I didn't know that. That's all those people at rehearsal. That's the
Emily
others.
Skinner and Lynn Halliday and the wonderful
Cameron Adams.
Yes, that's her name.
Powerhouses all.
Yeah.
Unbelievably brilliant.
I certainly hope that Jason is the one who gets to sing My Heart Belongs to Daddy.
Well,
just a snippet, but not nearly enough. I was a little disappointed.
No, Jason does some very special stuff in here besides being the host of the whole evening. I mean, he gets to be Cole Porter and Noel Coward and who else do you get to be?
Oh, there was somebody else, but I can't remember who. I don't know. I'm still memorizing my mind. Not Sophie Tucker.
All right, Steve.
The lady of the theater. I never shut up in the show. All I do is rehearse and go home and memorize. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Stephen, did some of this come about from the fact that a lot of people have been alleging that Mary Martin's getting forgotten as time goes on, that people don't know who she is?
Yes. I mean, in my world, sure. You know, I knew Mary myself. I was lucky enough to meet her a few times and talk to her on the phone from Rancho Mirage, and we corresponded. And I was friends with Merman. And Merman survives because she's a strangely iconic personality and because of TV and movies. And because Mary's movies were so long ago and she didn't really do those kind of comic things that Merman did on television, she is getting forgotten a little bit. There are people you ask them, oh, I love The Sound of Music. Julie Andrews is great.
Yeah, exactly.
Her role. Yeah, yeah. And without her, there would have been no show. Same thing with South Pacific.
It's her 100th.
And it's her 100th birthday.
Her birthday was December 1st, 1913. And so, it's her 100th anniversary, so we're celebrating that.
So, I mean, for me, you know, there's always been those two ladies, and I juggle them in my heart. And but Mary is more elusive because she, as we say in the show, she kept reinventing herself. The roles were so varied as opposed to Merman.
Well, that's so interesting to me because I'll never forget the first time I saw Rhythm on the River, and this was one sexy lady.
Yeah.
That's a new one.
Totally. No,
Rhythm on the River?
We do songs from Rhythm on the River.
We do?
Yes, we do. Ain't It a Shame About Mame?
That was from her Hollywood.
Yes, that's a Hollywood year.
Gotcha.
Yes. And yes, she was. Absolutely.
She was quite a babe.
That's how she started, the sex kitten in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, what a revelation that is when you see that picture because you don't see that coming. She also played a character in that called Cherry Lane, and I'd like to think that the Cherry Lane theater was named after her. You know,
Absolutely. I love the plot of Rhythm on the River where the two, Bing and her, are both ghostwriters for a Cole Porter-like songwriter. They go out on their own to sell their songs, and everyone says it's derivative of that songwriter. Great.
Now, I'm sorry. Mary Martin's longtime husband was Richard Halliday. Is Lynn Halliday a relative?
No,
I thought she was too.
It's just a happy coincidence. Lynn is married to B.H. Barry, the fight director on Broadway and director, and his real name is Halliday.
Oh, wow.
He was Barry Halliday as an actor. And when he became a fight director, I guess he thought it was tougher to be B.H. Barry. and so that's where it came from. And I've known Lynn for many moons before she was a Halliday.
They met in, like, one of his classes or something, like at an acting studio, and he was teaching fight or something, and she was one of his students.
And he beat her up, and
I think she pinned him to the ground. She took him down.
But no, there's no relationship there. But the fun stuff, by the way, is that we are having some Hallidays coming. We have Heller coming to the show. We have many of the grandchildren. We have Hagman's coming. The family is so excited about this because, just as you said, you know, we're not just inventing, we're remembering. We're remembering this great star, and the family's thrilled.
So, Stephen, is there a chance that all the shenanigans to create this show are going to be used to create another show, maybe The Road to Something?
The Road to Inventing Mary Martin. Well, yes. It could happen. I mean, my memoirs are in the works. And what memoirs. You know, so you never know. That's the quote Ogden Nash from One Touch of Venus. I like to give lyricists credit.
Yes.
So, what's next up? The Road to...
Oops.
The Inventing Mary Martin is going to be opening April 15th through May 18th at the York Theater Company, and you've covered all of that, and you are in the second week of rehearsals. What's in front of you right now for the rest of this rehearsal? Are you planning to take it on the road to someplace else?
Well, you never know. We gotta make a great show here, and we're so lucky at a place like the York where you have a run. It's not like you're opening off Broadway at the Cherry Lane and you could close off Broadway at the Cherry Lane. Here we have a chance at a real run, and the audiences already seem to be vying for tickets because they do remember Mary Martin and they are intrigued by it all. And so, I mean, we're hoping there's going to be a great afterlife for this, of course. We're going to do a recording, and we're going to plug the hell out of it. I don't know. Maybe London is next. Mary was very big in London. She played South Pacific and Hello, Dolly! At the Drury Lane, not to mention Pacific 1860 with Noel Coward, which almost killed her. And so I think she's actually very, very well-loved and remembered there. So we're hoping we just do a great job right now, start our previews, open, have a great time, bring the Hallidays and Hagmans in, and the audiences, I think, are just going to have a blast. The other thing about this is a real live review in the old-style way of it's got dancing and comedy and numbers and talking. It's not one of those song-to-song things where we stand around a piano. It's really fully staged and choreographed, and it's multimedia in that we're really using very, very inventive projections designed by Justin West. And I'm very excited about that, which is very part of the show. Jason's kind of a magician who makes it all happen. So we're a little ambitious.
Jason, I want to ask you a little bit about your past. A couple of weeks ago, we had Sean McDermott on, and he told us great stories about his put-in for falsettos. Do you have any recollections of good stories from falsettos?
Yes, I do. I just had the best time doing that show. I love that show so much. I remember my put-in. I was supposed to have a week and a half of rehearsals before I took over for Chip Zion, and Chip was ready to leave earlier, and so the put-ins had gone in well. So after 5 days of rehearsal, they said, you know, we think you're ready. Do you mind going on like 4 days earlier? So I was like, okay. So I had my final put-in, and Bill Finn came to see it the day before I was supposed to go on, and Randy Graff was there, you know, to be with me, and Greg Edelman. They were on the show at that time, and I was so hyper and so nervous. It was the first time I'd done it for Bill Finn, and he came back at intermission, and he goes, Jason, you're playing Mendel like George M. Cohan. I was so nervous and so broad. Can you imagine?
I encourage that.
Yes, you do.
That's okay.
So now, but in this show, I'm really playing the narrator like a heterosexual Jewish psychiatrist. Really, so perfect. But anyway, it was I had the most incredible time doing that show, and it ended up being a complete ball.
Jason has one of the best cabaret shows I've ever seen. So I hope you do it again, and people.
Well,
people,
as a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing it on two of our off nights during Mary Martin at Birdland.
Oh, great! Great.
Called 49 and a half shades of Graw. Oh my God, thank God you're all laughing. Thank God. Anyway, we just tried it out in LA and it was really good. My friend Heather Lee, who played Tessie Tura with Bernadette, directed it, and John Boswell musical directed it. So when we just tried it in LA and Feinstein's in San Francisco, and we had a ball. So we're going to be there May 5th and 12th at Birdland. So please come over.
That's great. I didn't know that. That really wasn't a plug.
Oh, I'm so happy to have a plug. I didn't plan to plug, but I'm always happy for a plug.
How is Feinstein's in San Francisco?
Beautiful. It's very classy. They've really classed up the joint, and the prices are not ridiculous. So, you know, my friends could come. And, the room basically looks, it's the same layout as it was when it was the Raz room, but they've just classed it up. There's nice chandeliers, and they have the color, and they painted it and got rid of some of the, it's not quite as, out there. It's classy. It's Michael Feinstein. It's lovely. So yes. I had a great time.
Coming to our opening.
Michael Feinstein
is?
Yes, God. Now I'm gonna have to. Now I'll have to warm up.
Well, guys, thanks so much for taking time out of the rehearsal, coming directly to us from the York Theatre Company. Remind you once again, Inventing Mary Martin, The Review of a Lifetime, is going to be playing April 15th through May 18th at the York. And we'll have links to all the information on our page at BroadwayRadio.com. So, guys, have a great time and enjoy this weather today. Hope you get a chance to get outside.
Thanks so much.
Oh, wait, it's over? I got to go back to rehearsal?
Yes.
Yes.
I to work, Jason.
Damn it to hell.
Come on.
Ow!
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah.
With us this morning, we have Eric Champney. Eric is a playwright who has got a play coming up at T. Schreiber Studios in a what's called the T. Schreiber Shorts. And Eric's play is called The Screen. So, Eric, good morning. Thanks for coming to visit. So tell us about...
Thank you very much.
Tell us about The Screens.
The Screens is a strange little play. It's about a... patient in a mental hospital who strikes up a conversation with an unfamiliar visitor, and during the course of that, he begins to realize that the two of them might be more connected than he realizes. And the play is kind of a mystery for the audience to solve. And once they do solve it, I hope they solve it, it's up to them to reconsider everything they've seen. And recognize the characters for who they really are and the devastating circumstances that surround them. It's a little bit of a puzzle that is kind of slowly put together throughout the process.
So I see here that you graduated, or you're in the MFA program at NYU?
I graduated last spring.
Last spring, and you're from Louisiana?
Yes, sir.
So how does one get from Louisiana to New York?
One begs and scrapes and pleads. What's interesting, though, is I actually went to NYU Tisch's International Campus in Singapore.
Oh.
And did my MFA work there. And so I've had quite a bit of an adventure theatrically, as far as what I've been exposed to. And right now I'm kind of on a liaison where I've taken the time to be in Louisiana because it's inexpensive, and to just submit my work to anyone and anyone who will read it and hopefully take notice of it and want to bring it to life faithfully and in a wonderful way.
Well, that explains one of my questions here, because I see on the Dramatists Guild's website in your profile there that you've been produced all over the world, and so this is an interesting way of going about to get your work to New York is to start in Singapore.
It's been a kind of crazy process. It began here in Shreveport, Louisiana, when I was 15, I was commissioned to write a play for a children's theater called Peter Pan Players. And that opened when I was 16 years old. And then from there, I had some good fortune with another play that was recognized by the Kennedy Center that would go on to the Bay Area Playwrights Festival and then ultimately in the Seattle Fringe Festival. And then with some time in Seattle and doing theater there and on the other side of it with design and marketing and just trying to get my hands dirty with everything that I could, I felt that it was time to get that MFA, and somehow I ended up in Asia, and it was quite wonderful, actually. It was surprise and not what I expected, but it really has.
Well, I'd like to hear about that. I'd like to hear about that. What would you say you were surprised and things you didn't expect? What's the biggest surprise to this date that you say, wow, you know, who knew that they did that in Singapore, or who knew that they didn't do that in Singapore?
Well, one of the most exciting things about Singapore is that they are in a theatrical renaissance,
if
you will.
Huh.
And so there is so much happening, and there are many young companies that are sowing their oats and really just kind of learning as they go from show to show. So it can be hit and miss. I saw a production of Equus there where the production was not so good, but the actor Ethan Shea, who played Alan, was extraordinary. And so these things happen. But I also got to see Lea Salonga in God of Carnage, and she ripped that to shreds. And
how interesting. Now, did they do the nudity in Equus?
They did.
Uh-huh. There's no problem with that type of thing over there or that you know of?
They had to take some special measures with the government there to get permission, the artistic license and whatnot. They did have to go through a little bit of a process to make that happen, but they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did make that happen. And I think that, unfortunately, because it was not something that occurs on a regular basis there, some people in the audience were going for the wrong reasons.
Uh-huh. And was it done in English or a different the native language, which is what, by the way, in Singapore? What do they speak there?
They speak Singaporean there.
Uh-huh. There's such a thing. Okay. All right. So it was done in that language, I assume?
Actually, no. The majority of the language that is spoken theatrically is English.
Oh, nice.
It's a bilingual country. They are very... they're very dead set on everybody learning English as well as Singaporean from the time they begin to speak so that they can interact with everything that's going on. There's such an international racket happening in Singapore with its connection to Australia and a lot of the American corporations that are there that it's just wiser for everyone to be able to communicate.
All right. So, Eric, one last question, quick question before you go. Do you know Toby Simkin? Toby from Needlelander Worldwide? He does a lot of producing in Asia and in Singapore and China, things like that. He might be a good connection for you to hook up with.
I would love to talk to him.
Yeah, Toby's a great guy to chat about that stuff. He's I think he's relocated. I think he lives in China now, but he's producing for the Needlelanders over in Asia, and so that's an interesting market that we don't think about very often, as insofar as being a big Broadway market. Eric, I know that you're about to get on a plane in a few minutes, so thank you so much for joining us. You're calling us from the airport, aren't you?
I am actually. I'm checked in and ready to head in your general direction, actually.
All right. Well, you have a safe flight. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, guys. Thanks.
Bye.
So on to the reviews. The three of us got a chance to see A Raisin in the Sun. And Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I've always thought this is one of the most significant plays in the history of American theater, because back in 1959... all the white theatergoers went into the play. Well, not all, of course, but nevertheless, I would think that many white theatergoers went into this play, did not want black people living next door to them. And when they came out of the theater, they said, you know, what's the harm, really? So it really did that. And my hat's off to Phil Rose for having done a wonderful job way back then and having the courage to produce it, because it's now part of the American repertory. This production, currently at the Barrymore Theater, of course, is very much in the news because Denzel Washington is in it, and of course anything like the cheers that he received when he came on was not simply entrance applause, they were entrance screams. People couldn't believe their good fortune. They were in the same room as Denzel Washington. There's a funny thing about this. He's substantially older than the character of Walter Lee Younger, a chauffeur who's hoping that the money his mother gets from an insurance grant from his father's death, is going to be used for a liquor store investment that he wants. She wants no part of that. But the interesting thing is that he's substantially older than Walter Lee usually is. So there's been a line in the script about that he's 40 years old now. And that's problematic because it indicates he got married later in life. And the thing is, one wonders why, if you get married later in life, you're a single man, even though you're making a chauffeur's salary, you would have some money in the bank. If there's one thing that costs a lot of money, it's marriage and children. And if there's one way to avoid spending a lot of money, it's not having marriage and not having children. So I think it's a little problematic when somebody's a little bit older, because I'm wondering what he was doing during those years when he could have been saving. He's very good. He's fine. Better, though, is the woman who took over for Diane Carroll, not that Diane Carroll even got into rehearsal, LaTanya Richardson Jackson, who I think is amazing as Lena Younger, the mother. And this is a woman we haven't seen very much on Broadway. She was in that revival of Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and that is it. We've never seen her on Broadway, but boy, does she pack power as the mother, who's a religious woman, who has great faith in God, who has courage, who's wise in many respects. And another example of a woman who may not have any type of education, but certainly has wonderful values that she's culled over the years. But I couldn't take my eyes off her. I thought she was truly magnificent, one of the best people I've ever seen to play the part. Frankly, you know, Felicia Rashad got a Tony some years back for playing this role. I thought this one was 804 times better. So what's also interesting for me, in addition to Anika Noni Rose being very good as Benita, no question, is that there were two people in the show that I didn't expect to see. One is Stephen McKinley Henderson playing the role of Bobo. He's a very distinguished actor. He's had a tremendous career in so many of the August Wilson plays, King Hedley, Ma Rainey, Fences, the revival anyway. And I don't think he's on stage for 3 minutes. And the fact that he would take this role is very interesting to me. And my hat's off to him for doing so well in saying, I want to be a part of this, even though I don't have much of a role. And the other surprise to me was David Cromer, who plays the white man, Carl Linder, who comes in and says, if you guys don't move, we'll make it worth your while. And David Cromer, of course, has had a terrific career in recent years directing. And to see him actually on stage in this small part was rather surprising to me, because there he was doing that tremendous revival of Our Town some years ago. And while his Brighton Beach memoirs didn't run long, it was certainly a fine production. And he did The House of Blue Leaves a few years ago. So we've known him as a director who knew that he would show up on stage. So that was interesting, too. But the power of this play is so wonderful. I have to say that because I was taking notes, the woman sitting next to me felt like talking. And I brought up this fact that the people back in 59, that their attitudes changed. And she said, well, I'm from Connecticut, and our ideas didn't change for a second. And she seemed rather proud of it. And I said, yes, but I guess you were the people who didn't go see the play. It would be different if you had. And boy, did that shut her up, I'll tell you. Now, that was the end of our discussion. But, but it's true. I mean, I can't imagine people not being affected by this play. I mean, when Ruth says, I will do anything to get out of this apartment, I will strap a baby on my back, I will wash floors 24 hours a day. God, anybody with any type of humanity says, please, you know, next door, there's a house. Come go. Come see it. Come live there. We want you to. We see you're good people. We see you're working hard. It's so hard to watch these people sharing a bathroom, hoping that the person down the hall isn't going to get into it. All that little stuff that Hansberry dramatized so well. A major play, a very fine production.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I agree with everything Peter said. I'd also like to single out the boy who plays Travis, the son, Bryce Clyde Jenkins. I thought he was one of the most natural child actors I've ever seen on Broadway. And, you know, as Peter said, everyone else, almost everyone else is so good. LaTanya Richardson Jackson is truly superb. I very much like Felicia Rashad, Miss Jackson was really amazing. And, you know, I mean, who knows? We'll never know. I cannot imagine Diane Carroll playing such a simple, completely non-glamorous character.
I agree.
Presumably she would have done it that way because there's no other way you can do it. But mm-hmm. that would have been fascinating to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, might have been a train wreck. Maybe that's why she left. I don't know. But don't you agree, Peter?
Oh, indeed. 100%. Yeah. It's not a logical casting move as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, go on.
I very much enjoyed Denzel Washington for the most part throughout the play. I thought that when it was getting to the more dramatic moments that he was not quite what he should have been. But then I have to say, I thought he completely fell apart at the end to the point where it almost, well, I'm not going to say it ruined everything, but it really changed my opinion of his entire performance. There's a scene at the end where he, out of desperation, he decides he's going to capitulate to the David Cromer character, Carl Lindner. And you know, this is after they've told Lindner off and said, get out of our house. You know, how dare you? But now he's reconsidering because Walter has lost a lot of the money, which is, I won't get into that. And so he does this whole speech where he's satirizing, like, step in, fetch it type speech, like, oh, yes, yeah, we're going to sell you and we're not going to move into, you know. And it's supposed to be an incredibly dramatic moment of self-loathing, but he did it so ineptly that at the performance I went, the entire audience was laughing as if it was a sitcom. And, you know, that might partly be due to the immaturity of some people in the audience, such as the people like the woman, the Yahoo, who like went yow the first time he kissed his wife on stage, even though the first kiss was just, you know, it wasn't even highly sexual. It was just a tender little kiss, you know. So there were a few of those people in the audience, but I don't think there were a lot of them, and I really think that his very poor playing of that scene just really was the main reason why everyone was laughing as if it was an episode of The Jeffersons or something.
Michael, were you there on Friday night?
I was there, yes.
Okay, because, yes, that happened in my performance, too, and so we were there the same night. Okay, fine. Yes, I can corroborate that that's exactly what happened, right.
Did you feel that it was largely his fault, and did you feel that that was a big kind of blot on the production?
No, neither, actually. Okay. I do see what you're saying, by the way.
Okay.
But I think that's very dangerous territory, and I think a lot of people seeing the play for the first time just didn't know how to react to it. There had been a lot of humor in the production, so as a result, I think it may have been that the audience said, "Well, we're going with this. This is funny," and it's too bad. Ironically enough, when I was walking out of the theater, a colleague said to me, "Isn't it a shame?" The people were laughing at that moment. So it hit him the same way, too.
Yeah.
But I do think even with all that laughter, the message came through.
Oh, well, I hope so. Yes.
Yeah.
And thereafter it came through. But also, you know, I never caught this before, but I thought I noticed a plot hole. And maybe you can clear this up for me, Peter. So Lena gets $10,000 total,
right,
for the insurance payment.
Right.
She says that she puts down, I believe, $3,500 for the house. And then she shows her trust in Walter by saying, I want you to take $3,000 of the rest of it and put it in the bank for Benita's college. Right.
Yes.
And then the rest of it you can use as you please. Right. But then Walter loses all of that rest of the money except for, right, the down payment on the house, and everyone is devastated. But right, then they're suddenly acting as if they were going to use some of that money to continue to pay, like, for payments on the house. But she's already said no, that it was part of it was for the college, and part of it was for Walter.
No, I think that she they talked about that in the prior scene, that they'd all get a job and they'd all pitch in and they'd tough to make it.
No, they do say that, but I mean, it's just like, it seems like
I think the wind just got knocked out of their sail when they lost it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I get you.
I get the impression that things are going to be tougher than they could have been, but nevertheless, they're still going to make it work.
And also, it did, again, maybe it was his acting or something. It seemed like the recovery from his loss of all of that money was rather abrupt. But that's, I mean, obviously that's very difficult to play. And I didn't feel that in the last production. I wish I could kind of see the last one. Well, actually, there's that TV version.
there is, isn't there? Yeah. Right.
Maybe I should watch that again. And because I thought they both had their strengths. This one I thought was very, very strong overall, except that I thought he came up short in the dramatic moments. And just one more thing, they played before the show an extensive interview, audio interview with Lorraine Hansberry, obviously from a long time ago because she died very young, tragically.
Yeah.
And she makes a point that I see what she means, but one example she gave, I agree, and the other, I really don't. She talks about very stereotypical portrayals of black people in pieces written by white people, and she names two, Carmen Jones and Porgy and Bess. Now, the thing is, Carmen Jones, as much as I love it for what it is and the lyrics and blah, 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 I have to admit there are a lot of very, very broad, dated stereotypes in that. So I can see why she said that. But Porgy and Bess, you know, is based on a work by DuBose Hayward. And and although he was not black, I think I made this point before, he spent his life growing up in the midst of all of these people, these black people that he was writing about. So I think it's very, you know, I think that gets very tricky when you say that somebody shouldn't be writing about, you know, these people just because they're a different race. I mean, if you, I think living and knowing with people is more important than the sharing their actual skin color or ethnicity or nationality or whatever. So I was a little surprised that she made that point. And ironically, before the final scene of this production of Raisin in the Sun, what did they play but a musical excerpt from Porgy and Bess?
Mm.
So there you go.
I saw the same performance that you guys both did on Friday evening, and I was blown away. And it was interesting because my wife had never seen Raisin in the Sun. She didn't know anything about it. And I was I had seen Raisin a long time ago and was piecing together actually Clybourne Park pieces, sure, on the other side, saying, "Oh, okay, that makes more sense to me now." And but I was blown away by this production, and I agree with everything that you guys said. And I have to say that my wife was a bit confused because the Denzel age thing. Mm. And I think that that's the only thing that you can say about this production that is problematic, is he's not age appropriate for this role. And it makes, and talking with her about it and saying, you know, if he's a 25-year-old guy or maybe, 20-year-old guy or something like that, you see that a much different take on the way he reacts and is immature in so many ways. But sometimes you're looking up on stage and you recognize Denzel Washington and you're like, and it doesn't sink in that he should be making the play calls for a younger person that's making those young rash decisions.
Well, that's also, yeah. I mean, as you say, that's also part of the issue when you hire somebody who's well known, or even someone who's been around. I mean, we know intellectually how old they are, and that helps us. I mean, sometimes it's hard to get that out of our head, you know. Even if we didn't know, we might say, oh, you know, he looks 40, you know, or but they up that age anyway. So it's part of both things, you know, contribute to it.
But I feel bad for the Tony voters because it's going to be a hard.
Oh, it is.
It's going to be a hard season in the play category. In the revivals and in the plays and in the best actor categories. I mean, LaTanya Richardson Jackson, I can't imagine how she could have not been the first choice. Mm-hmm. She's so amazing.
And yes.
Anika Nani Rose and Sophie, just amazing. Just the whole cast was amazing. And
well, the reason she wasn't the first choice because nobody knows who she is, and certainly Diane Carroll still has some sort of name value. So.
But what's wonderful in this case, obviously, is that they didn't need any more star power than
Denzel. I was just going to say that, yeah.
So now somebody who was previously not that well known is going to have all this wonderful, highly deserved acclaim for her incredible performance.
Yeah, I was going to say we were there the same night. Was there any seats available near you? The place was packed.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. Not at all.
There's not a seat to be bought. So to bring in another name, was it worth it? Last week, Peter and I talked about Aladdin and how much I enjoyed it, and Michael got a chance to see it this week. So Michael, we have a full schedule, but do you have a few words to say about Aladdin?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. I just thought that it was so aggressive and mm-hmm. so loud that that it really was counterproductive. I didn't think there was any charm in it at all. It was so hard sell that it actually wound up kind of repelling me, and it's really too bad because I think it is one of the better Disney animated films and also kind of a unique in the sense that it's the emphasis is so much more on comedy in that film than in the others like Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, all of those that came out in that period. And the other thing that's kind of unique is it's the only one I can think of that has a male as the central character. So, that's really interesting and just makes it seem different and fresher in a way than all those other shows.
Well, of course, there was Tarzan.
That's true. Yes, that is another one. But
I understand why you forgot it.
And also, that was even less of a musical, I guess.
It was. Yeah, yeah. It really was. Yeah.
That's my main comment about this. And then the only other thing is that I had heard about this. There were three homophobic quote unquote jokes in this that really offended me. And I don't know why they're there. They really don't seem necessary. And I wish to God they would cut them out because it really pisses me off. Did either of you notice these three homophobic jokes?
No, I didn't notice.
I'm afraid. Yeah.
Well, in the beginning, it's at at the bazaar or whatever, and Jafar and Iago come over to Aladdin because they want to get him to go and get the lamp. And Jafar says, "I've been watching you," and Iago says, "But not in a weird way."
Oh yeah.
And then later on, the genie meets Aladdin, they somehow end up in some kind of an embrace with, actually, I think the genie's leg is like in Aladdin's arm, like as if a dance move or something. And then the genie says something like, "This is getting a little weird." And then at the very end, just a throwaway, but the three Aladdin's three sidekicks, they're talking about how they're going to now come in and be part of the court because Aladdin is now going to be the prince. And one of them says, I'm going to be this and I'm going to be that. And then one of them says, and I'll be the court choreographer. And he does a little dance thing. Uh-huh. And Aladdin says, "Weird, but okay." Now, first of all, why is it weird when everyone's been dancing for 2.5 hours? Sure. And second of all, why does Disney keep using the word weird to mean gay or queer?
Yeah.
And this is directly also from the film and the stage version of The Lion King, where the very incredibly gay character of Uncle Scar, who happens to be the villain, in the same way that Jafar, who comes across as very gay, is the villain in Aladdin, where Jafar says something to Simba, and Simba says, "You're really weird, Uncle Scar," and Scar says, "You have no idea."
Wow.
So I wish they would stop it. Mm-hmm. You know, I really wish they would. And I think I'm actually going to write a letter to Tom Schumacher or somebody.
Because, well, you know, it's kind of interesting because, of course, there are those wonderful the company's been very good to gays.
Yes.
So I'm told, you know, so it's kind of surprising to see this double standard.
I don't think it occurs to them. I think they don't quite realize what. But that I mean, that's
yeah, how I bet that's it.
Trust to yeah. me. You know, I mean, I don't know what. In all of those cases, it clearly seems like it's homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
So I that really upset me.
Hmm. Ray McNeil, who's a listener, tweeted us on Twitter, because that's where you tweet people.
That's where you tweet.
Okay. That there he corrected us that the opening sequence actually was Robin Williams. And so thanks, Raven, for that as well.
Yeah, but again, it's and actually this I'm glad he brought that up, because this, let's just clarify, in the film, the song Arabian Nights is in fact sung by Bruce Adler, as I said, Bruce Adler, who
yeah.
we saw on Broadway in Crazy for You and some other things. But then the dialogue of that character, I forget his name, it's called The Merchant, I believe, apparently is credited to Robin Williams. And that's interesting, because in several of the Disney movies, the singing voice is different from the speaking voice. And then sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, depending on the movie or the role. But for example, in Aladdin, the role of Aladdin is sung by Brad Kane, who was on Broadway as Arpad in the She Loves Me revival, and then he was also in the 94 Grease revival, and I guess he must have left the business, because I don't see any credits for him since then. And then also in the movie, the Jasmine is sung, and it's only one song, I guess, A Whole New World, by Leah Salonga, but the dialogue is done by another actor. So for whatever reason, sometimes Disney did that, and that needs clarification.
Hmm. All right, so let's move forward. Peter and Michael, I'm tremendously jealous of you. Got a chance to see Guys and Dolls at Carnegie Hall on Thursday night. Oh, tell us, was it as wonderful as it sounds like it was?
I thought so.
I liked it quite a bit, though I will say this, I was a little nervous about Len Cariou beginning, because I didn't think he was really in the moment. I wasn't he seemed uncertain of his lyrics in Follow the Fold. However, when he got to More I Cannot Wish You, my, what a tender rendition, the best I've ever heard. And that's where he really channeled all his energies. It was really quite moving. This Sierra Bodges, boy, I'm telling you, she just shows up everywhere. And whatever she does, it's certainly worth seeing her. Quite lovely in the role that won Isabel Biglietone, which is a little surprising when one thinks that Adelaide is the showier role. And Megan Mullally certainly was showy indeed, in the best sense of the word. So it was nice for those who weren't around 22 years ago to see Nathan Lane do it. What a nice opportunity to see him do it again. And he was really into it, which was really quite good. And Patrick Wilson was quite fine too, especially in the very important scene deep in the second act where Adelaide complains to him about Nathan's behavior, and he talks about, why do you always try to change men? Why must that be, all you women who try to change men? although, of course, men do get changed in this in this show. You know, I'm going to bring up something about Guys and Dolls, though, that's always bothered me, and that is the fact that Adelaide has been lying to her mother in Rhode Island, that they've been married for a while and they have 5 children. In fact, as time goes on, the 6th is on the way. I just think that a grandmother of 5 would come see her grandchildren once at least. You know, I mean, I don't understand how this woman stays in Rhode Island. And I guess you can't say that she's, you know, bedridden or anything like that, because that would be too serious
a
thing to throw into the show. But I have a real problem with a woman who isn't interested enough in seeing 5 of her grandchildren. So, but aside from that, Guys and Dolls is a perfect musical, and it certainly was well served at Carnegie Hall.
Well, yeah, I guess you're right about the mom in Rhode Island. And I guess I have thought that too, but I just say, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, I know.
What a great great, great show. This has been quite a week for Frank Lesser, because not only did we have this, but we had The Most Happy Fellow, which I guess we'll discuss next week because Peter hasn't seen it yet. I think, by the way, Peter, I'm pretty sure it's Sierra Bogus.
Oh, I have no idea. I'll take any correction on
that.
You know?
I'm pretty positive. But yes, excellent cast across the board, and extremely well directed by Jack O'Brien, I thought, as well directed as a full stage production. You know what a friend of mine mentioned, and I didn't know the answer, and I think maybe I'm going to ask around at Carnegie Hall. It was only one night. And I wonder why they would put all that effort and get up such a wonderful production for only one night. Usually when they do things like this at the Philharmonic, for example, they do four or five performances. And you certainly think that Guys and Dolls with a cast like this would warrant ticket sales for more than one. Mm-hmm. So I wonder about that. I don't know what the answer is, so I'll see if I can find out. This was the Orchestra of St. Luke's, by the way, conducted by Rob Fisher, who used to be Encore's music director for many years. And I thought it was fabulous. We haven't seen a lot of Megan Mullally lately. It was great to see her again. I think she's maybe the first brunette Adelaide I've ever seen. Of course, Faith Prince wasn't blonde. She was, reddish. But that was interesting and lent a little different tone to the character. I loved her voice, which was similar to what we've heard before, but not exactly the same. Sometimes she sounded to me like Kristen Chenoweth.
Yes, that's a good point. That hadn't occurred to me, but I see your point. Yeah.
Yeah, that little Minnie Mouse kind of thing, or whatever you want to call it. And, yes, everyone was fantastic. Len Carew did get what sounded like a very sincere ovation, not a standing ovation, but just a very prolonged ovation after More I Cannot Wish You. And I think that it was very well deserved. I thought Patrick Wilson was slightly miscast. There's something about him that seems so so clean cut and kind of Midwest corn fed that not exactly what Sky Masterson is. But having said that, I thought his acting and singing were terrific. He really does have an excellent voice that, again, he hasn't maybe had as much opportunity to use as he would have if he'd had if he had focused his career on Broadway. But it's always great to see him and excellent, supporting people like Lee Wilcoff, Robert Cloessi, Christopher Fitzgerald, John Tracy Egan. Really a wonderful, wonderful night.
All right. So as I said, I hate you both.
Yes.
So. Sorry.
No, it's it just sounds like an amazing night, and to see all the reports of it afterwards. I hope that did you guys notice if maybe they were recording it or videotaping it or
I didn't notice. No, I'm sorry. Actually, that's a lie. I did notice. I made a point of looking around, and I didn't see any cameras. And I thought, what a loss! Because they may have filmed it archivally, just with a couple of cameras in the back. But this would have been a perfect candidate for filming for commercial distribution, because there's no as much as I actually like the movie version, but it's quite different. So this would have been great, and there's no commercial video of basically the original version. So and I think, again, there's a market for that, especially with Nathan Lane and Megan Mullally and Patrick Wilson and Sierra Bogus. So that seems like a missed opportunity.
Hey, speaking of that movie, by the way, that scene where Sky first approaches Sarah in the mission is so much better in the movie than it is in the stage play. It has been severely rewritten, severely enhanced, and it makes a great power-packed punch. I remember the first time I went to the theater to see Guys and Dolls with my girlfriend, and when that scene started, I said, wait till you see this scene. And it didn't turn out to be the scene that's in the movie, and I thought it would be. And afterwards, she turned to me and said, what was so remarkable about that? But really, if you haven't seen that scene in the movie, I really urge it. It's wonderfully rewritten and with far more power.
I just watched it yesterday, Peter, and you're absolutely right. It's also, I would say, maybe three times as long.
Yeah, it really is. You know,
because they said, you know, Mankiewicz said to himself, well, I've got Marlon Brando and Gene Simmons, and let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. One of the strangest things in the movie, in fact, it's inspired my Sony column for this week, is that A Bushel in a Peck, which was a big hit song at the time, was dropped for the movie. And it's very strange to me that it was, not just because that Pep Me Papa song is not as good, in my opinion, when you have a song that the nation knows, I don't understand why you drop it.
Well, the reason given, which...
Oh, you know? Oh, good.
Yeah, yes, no. Good. They said that it was such a big hit that they thought it would actually date the film. Because, let's see, the stage show was 50.
50, right, 50.
And the film was 55.
55, right.
So yeah. You were talking about something that was this tremendous, tremendous top 40 hit. And then that was their reasoning, right or wrong.
Gee, that's so bizarre to me. I mean, yeah. I mean, like in an era where we see a little night music often sold as the Send in the Clowns musical, yes. I don't see why having a hit song is a liability in any way, shape, or form. So
right, and also it's not like they needed to, you know, they tended to write new songs for films so they would be eligible for Oscars, but that wasn't the only new song, and it wasn't even the major new song. So if I'm with you, I wish they had kept it, and it's also a song performed in the nightclub.
Yeah.
So even if it was dated, quote unquote, I don't think that would have been an issue. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure. It still makes no sense to me anyway.
All right. So both of you came out of that performance and went across town to via the transport group to see I Remember Mama. So Michael, why don't you start us off with I Remember Mama?
Well, let me say first off that the acting was extraordinary. Barbara Andress as Mama, absolutely beautiful performance. I will never forget it. Barbara Barry as Katrin, Alice Cannon, Lynn Cohen, Rita Gardner, Susan Lehman, Heather McRae, Phyllis Somerville, Louise Sorrell, and Dale Soles. All of those people other than Barbara Andress and Barbara Barry playing multiple roles. And therein, I guess, lies part of my major problem with this production, and I guess I'm in the minority. I thought the concept is that all of the roles, male or female, are played by women of a certain age. I would say, fair to say, over 60, over 65.
Sure.
Not only that, but as I said, all of the roles except those two were doubled. And that to me led to quite a bit of confusion, because not only that, but aside from those two things, there was at least one scene where two different actresses played the same character in two subsequent scenes. And I don't know. I mean, I maybe if you know the play really well, there were several points where I really was confused. And on top of the fact that there is it's a unit set. The audience is sitting in two rows around the entire periphery of the gym at Judson down by NYU, Washington Square South. And the set consists of a bunch of tables on the floor of the gym with memorabilia, photos and other kinds of memorabilia seated on top. So you never get any specific indication of where you're supposed to be. And a lot of it does take place in their home. But for example, there was one point where suddenly somebody said a line about being in the hospital, and I hadn't yet realized that they were there until someone said that line. So there were several moments where it was distracting to me in that way and confusing. And also, I guess the argument is that if one were to do this play traditionally, that it is it's very sentimental and very old-fashioned in many ways. And the argument is that maybe modern day audiences would not accept it if done that way. But I would give the counter argument and say this is not a play that we see done that often at all. It's not a case like Our Town, which interestingly enough, the Transport Group did some years ago with older people in the roles of George and Emily. I didn't see it, but that was another very well regarded production. So I think that, you know, that in a case like that where something is rarely produced, I don't see the need for a concept production. And although in many cases I felt that the Transport Group's concept productions have worked beautifully, in this case I really thought it worked against the play and also did not help the superb actresses in all of these roles.
Peter, what did you think?
I cried like a baby, and so did my girlfriend. And what was I was there at opening night, and because we're all sitting around the perimeter of this rectangle, I was able to see Mary Testa and Anne Hereda and Jackie Hoffman have the same reaction. Beatific looks on their faces through the entire night. And when do you see a beatific look on Jackie Hoffman's face, I ask you? So tremendously, you know, at the end, I said to Linda, boy, I'm so reminded of my Aunt Elaine and my Aunt Vera, to which Linda said, I'm so reminded of my Aunt Dottie and my Aunt Phyllis. And I can't wait for somebody to come over from Tokyo and say, I can't believe this was ever a success in America. It's so Japanese, that famous line attributed to Fiddler. Right. So I was tremendously moved. And I have to admit, I'm not very good with plays where the mother is the smartest one in the room, probably because my mother thought she was the smartest one in the room. But that's another story. Anyway, so... I was tremendously. I would love to see a traditional production of this play because I agree with Michael that it's strange. I started thinking, well, maybe the concept is that all these old women live in a senior citizen facility and they decide to put on a play. That's the best I can do. I don't know how this occurred to Jack Cummings III, but nevertheless, I'm grateful for the chance to see this play where we see a woman who truly would be a CEO of a company if she were living today and had the chances that she didn't have then, because she makes things happen. She's never supercilious about it. I mean, one of the things that bothers me about A Majority of One, the movie with Rosalind Russell, is whenever there's a problem, she suddenly puts on this glazed smile and has tired eyes as if to say, you people aren't as smart as I am. I have all the answers. I know. I have the wisdom. You can't be expected to have the wisdom because you're not a mother and there is no greater station in life than that. And that doesn't happen here at all. Barbara Andres, coming out of nowhere, I don't think Broadway's seen her since
Wasn't
Rex.
She just wonderful?
Oh, phenomenal beyond belief. Because she has the wisdom. She doesn't flaunt it. More to the point... she is so sincere in trying to figure things out. She is improvising as she goes along. I don't mean the actress now. What I mean is mother is improvising as she goes along, trying to figure out things, making decisions, hoping they're the best decisions. Quite often they turn out to be. I'm sure the reason we don't see a revival of this play is because there's a million people in it, and that is a problem. So I don't know. But still, even with the concept being a bit on the bizarre side, I was so moved every step of the way. And I'm very surprised it took me as much as it did, because in high school we read the play aloud. I remember in class I played Uncle Chris. And while Lynn Cohen was very good, I don't know that you can compare it to my Uncle Chris. Seriously. Anyway, you know, I hadn't really encountered the play since then. I was a teenager then. So I missed all the subtleties and I missed the power of it and all that. So quite a moving show. And I think it is one of the must-see events of the theater season, even though, as I say, I don't understand the concept particularly. But just a chance to see this play must be seized.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, it sounds like it is a ticket to be had. And it's going to be at the Gym at Judson through April 20th, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes. If you want to take a look at that. All right, so let's wrap up. Anything else you guys want to add before we go for this week? We do as happened for the last, you know, 5 or so years that we've done this broadcast, this time of year we get kind of crazy, and we can't fit everything into the show, so we have a lot of things that we've seen already this week that are going to be in next week's show. So we're going to talk about Most Happy Fella from Encores, which is closing today, but we're going to talk about that next week. We're going to talk about If Then next week, Heathers, Appropriate, and Red Vienna, as well as a few other things that we see this week coming up. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and it will be automatically streamed to you. Broadway World Radio also plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about in today's broadcast. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm in love.